Bring me your finest brain meats.
The 60s unleashed something extraordinarily powerful that is still reverberating and echoing in this culture and actually in the world. And what that released was a recognition in people that they were free to change institutions and themselves. And each of us is figuring out how to do that. But social institutions which have power structures are very threatened by that kind of change. And what we are coming to appreciate is the way in which we can go about changing in such a way that the transformations are gentle, but they aren't necessarily violent.
I'm Leisha, and I'm here to welcome you to the inaugural episode of the Brain Meets podcast. In this show, we'll listen to a conference call recorded on Friday, October 21st, 2011, in which Willow spoke to an international assortment of hackers and makers about the Occupy movement, tools available for protesters, and issues surrounding the safety and security of protesters on the streets and on the internet. For additional information on any of the tools or organizations mentioned in the conversation, please check the links in the podcast notes. Enjoy the show, and then go do something marvelous.
Hello, I'm Willow, and you are listening to Brain Meets.
All right, so let's do a round of introductions first. We'll go alphabetical order as it's listed on the Google Doc. So, Ari, you want to start?
Sure. I'm Ari. I live in New York City. I am Tensory on Twitter. I have developed an interest in encryption and communication, secure communications for activists, just as a personal desire. And I have a lot of friends who are involved in the protests. I am not on the ground personally, but I think that many of us have supporting roles that we can play, and those mesh with my own like personal goals in software development. So that's what interests me.
I'm Zonar Seita. I'm a security analyst and a hacker, and generally look at how systems break and fail better. I'm Dymaxion on Twitter, D-Y-M-A-X-I-O-N. I've been on the ground at a few of the protests, live tweeting, especially some of the police interactions, and also work on security tools for protests and communication tools for protests.
I'm Matthew Borgatti. I'm GiantEye on Twitter, and I'm a physical maker, builder, doer person. Most of my stuff has been engineering giant sculptures and making kind of mimetic art where the internet is my medium. Things like the Pillow Maze and Hackerspace Passports and Mystery Science Theater 3000 Shades, things like that. I'm actually heavily focused in how human beings, like, in really thin slices and in really quick ways, use a lot of different mental equipment to see the whole of something from really, really tiny snapshots. So branding, marketing, getting an idea across very quickly, or from an industrial design end, like how you know to pick up a game controller in the way that it needs to be picked up. I have a lot of subtle visual cues. So I need to bring this to protesters to get messages across quickly, empathetically, and kind of subverting people's conscious mechanisms for ousting people from their mental worlds.
My name is Ruben Starset. I am a human mechanist in San Francisco. I make great things happen. Certainly, as far as my movement has been going, I've been working with a couple other people at the San Francisco Hackerspace Noise Bridge to provide or help provide power and logistics for making means of communication happen. I'm in this because I don't know if the Occupy movement is the right thing, but it sure beats sitting on your hands.
I'm Simon McCarthy. I'm a kind of hacker activist based in Iceland. I've been somewhat involved with various kind of technological approaches to the concept of democracy for several years. I was involved with the Icelandic protests in 2008, 2009, and been since then just doing a lot of work around the concept of what can we do to improve the current kind of democratic situation of the world. So I'm kind of here as somebody who's been watching the Occupy movement from afar. I've been watching the stuff in Spain and throughout Europe, and slightly occupied with the events in North Africa this summer and this year in total. So and that's sort of rare in a sense.
Very good, thank you. And I'm Willow Blue. I guess I'm your moderator of sorts today. I'm with a myriad of groups, one of which is Geeks Without Bounds, just kind of linking together hacker and maker spaces with humanitarian and disaster response. So I care about Occupy because it's people actually engaging with their environment and with the things that are happening around them, and that makes me happy. So to start us off, Samari, do you want to tell us about some history or some of the meta ideas behind Occupy?
So I kind of see this as a historical progression that kind of started. Well, I mean, we could go back indefinitely. There's been peasant uprisings and whatnot throughout history, and somehow we never managed to solve the problems when they come around. Hopefully, this time it will be different, but. If we look back to like 2008, 2009, when we had the housing crisis and the start of this entire collapse, that kind of triggered a lot of problems that still haven't been resolved. For some reason, it's kind of been mitigating through Europe, started maybe in Iceland and Ireland, and then through to Greece and various European countries have been collapsing. And people are becoming increasingly annoyed with the current situation of the world. Then, about December last year, the events in Tunisia sparked a splatter of revolutions in that neck of the woods. Incredibly interesting stuff. Several dictators toppled. Currently, what looks like the makings of a civil war in Syria. At some point throughout all of this, and probably just linking back to maybe the beginnings of the housing crisis in the U.S., the Occupy movement is kind of emerging from just an immense amount of tension that's been building up for years and years and years. So we're kind of at the point now that I think that the people who are going out on the streets are just tired of all of this nonsense, and they want to see something change, even if they don't necessarily have all the answers.
Can you define for me what you keep referring to? So things were a certain way even a long time ago with peasants and hierarchies in that way, and there are issues still occurring. Can you at least give examples of what some of those are?
Okay, well, if you look maybe to the 17th, 18th centuries, the writings of Thomas Hobbes, where Hobbes more or less suggested that without a strong centralized government, human society would dissolve into a war of all against all, and everybody would basically end up dead. And this was immensely useful to the ruling parties at the time, which thought, well, you know, maybe the people who were in control could use this as a way of leveraging against the peasants. And that's, you know, that kind of started this lineage that went through the Industrial Revolution with increasing of manufacturing capacity, and we all know kind of the basic Marxist theories and whatnot. Through the centralization mechanisms, through the kind of progression into more centralized, more urbanized, more regulated kind of a super state society, we've basically become more and more disenfranchised. The general public have lost more and more of their ability to be self-sufficient and to accomplish things that they want to accomplish in life, and are now more or less forced to do whatever the commercial proprietarian bidding is at each time. I'm not sure if that kind of sums it up, but I'm trying to be brief.
That does sum it up nicely, thank you. Let's do a go-round. So, Ari, if you want to start, if you have anything to add or ask.
Yes, I just want to follow on to that with kind of why here and why now. So I'm in New York, and I remember 2 years ago being steeped in the news of financial crashes and crises and, you know, images of traders holding their heads and just despairing at really the work that they had done to undo the economy of the United States. And if you live in New York City, you know, Wall Street is in your backyard. And I think it's incredibly symbolically powerful that people here, as well as elsewhere, said, hey, you know, this is a human problem created by people that live and work in this city. And we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we have a responsibility that, you know, we've talked about many times in the past, but we've never really acted upon in recent memory, to just take to the streets and try to make a statement that this is unacceptable. So I find it incredibly symbolically powerful that it started with Occupy Wall Street and it resonated with people across the country and then around the world.
Very cool. Thank you. Ella, anything?
Yeah, I think there's also a larger context. If you look at the way things were going in the Middle East and North Africa and the way things were going in Europe, and especially the UK, but also throughout the rest of Europe, with a lot of the university occupations that we were seeing, there's been a shift in sort of the feeling around a lot of these protests. There was a long time kind of, I guess, you know, if I was going to put a single date on it, you could say it was after the G20 in Seattle, but you know, somewhere around there, there was this kind of awareness that, hey, there's this script for how a protest works, and yes, there may be a big riot, but absolutely nothing is going to change. And somewhere along the way, these folks started suddenly having an impact again. And, you know, whether it was a different kind of violence that was less symbolic, more real, or just a different sort of space of interaction, something changed, and I think that change was part of what allowed these protests to become effective again.
I've got a question and just a thing I'd like to add. The role of technology has been really fascinating in Arab Spring and in the development of the Occupy movement, and there's a program called RSA Animate that has been, it's a very amusing YouTube series, where speakers have little animated talks. One person summed this up very well in my mind, that the use of technology has been turning the implicit into explicit. That if you can anonymously say, I am a person in Egypt and I also don't like the things that you don't like, after you reach a certain sort of mass of people doing this, it becomes part of your social consciousness that everyone feels as I do. Everyone is equally upset with this. So even if I can't walk out into the street and protest, there is a protest going on that can't be stopped in kind of the hearts and minds. And I think that turning these images very often into explicit things that take up social space, that, you know, it's all over your Facebook wall, it's all over your Twitter feed, can solidify a movement in ways that have never been seen before. The other thing I just want to ask was if anyone knew of the role of, if Anonymous had a role in the Occupy movements, or if a lot of the symbolism, a lot of the Guy Fawkes masks has been kind of because it was an easy symbol to adopt.
This is Ari. I just want to comment on that. I am being reminded of all of the media around WikiLeaks that was current as of about 8 months ago now. And I believe, without being involved in it myself, I believe that the people who comprise Anonymous were responsible for a lot of the media pressure that was generated around WikiLeaks around WikiLeaks persecution for what they were doing. The reaction to that stirred a great amount of public comment, both for and against what WikiLeaks was doing. So that's where I see the Anonymous, I don't know whether to call it a movement or a group, but that's where I see that involvement coming in.
I believe that Anonymous had declared a basic cease and desist to some of the banking people a while ago, but I will have to dredge up that post.
Yeah. The kind of point that Anonymous comes into this is they started off as an anti-Scientology thing, spawned off of 4chan, and kind of after the interventions of the wise bearded man and whatnot, the steamrolled into this thing where they became more and more politically active and politically potent. And especially after maybe the shutdown of Visa and MasterCard against WikiLeaks, they started to more actively target the banking sector, which I think is fascinating in and of itself. But one point, because Ella mentioned the G20 in Seattle kind of being the spawn point of all of this, the point where the breakage occurs. Today in Paris, there was the EG20 meeting, which is kind of the G20's approach to how are we going to control the internet. And, the reason why this is happening now, and they had the EG8 a couple of months ago, it kind of all comes down to the same point, that states are increasingly becoming very, very worried about what the internet can actually create.
Okay, so that's a good point to move on with, of what the internet can actually create, into how are geeks specifically getting involved, and how are the tools that are being created impacting how this movement is progressing. So right now I'm sitting at Jigsaw Renaissance, and we've done a Occupy Hack contingent today, most of which is being done remotely, actually, not in Seattle, but I'm glad to know that we're working with people all over the place on a myriad of different tools that hopefully will be easy enough to use that anyone can jump on and make use of them, but also will specifically address some of the issues that are going on with Occupy.
Way back in, I guess, November of last year, we started seeing a tool that was coming out of the UK. So the student movements in London were having huge problems being kettled by riot police when they were having big protests. And they decided that this wasn't very nice. So some folks wrote a tool called Suki, which is basically designed to allow protesters to coordinate and avoid riot police, avoid getting kettled, and generally kind of have a more successful day out. So I've been doing some work with them on security work to try and get that tool pushed towards kind of the next generation, towards a more functional tool for, communication, secure communication in that kind of embodied on-the-ground context.
Awesome. So a lot of these tools are being reappropriated or misappropriated from what they originally intended for, to suit not only the needs at hand, but also make it a little bit safer for the protesters themselves, the occupiers, whatever you care to call them. And
yeah, the Suki was built on Ushahidi.
Okay.
Oh, awesome.
And there was an issue with Ushahidi before Suki that was police were using it to follow what the protesters were planning, so that then they could figure out where they were at.
I think it raises a good point that your software doesn't natively work for you, and it's kind of important by the part what we're using to kind of congregate our data and congregate ourselves, because the software you use has been, especially in say phone apps, likes your data and loves to share it in ways that are unintentional. And for security auditors, people who know what's going on, it's important to give out tools that are implicitly secure.
Well, and this is Ari. I've been trying to promote interest and adoption of some of the Guardian Project's work. I'll jump into the tools conversation that way by saying that there are already a couple of efforts to, well, actually myriad efforts to make anonymization and semi-secured communication for phone, you know, for mobile platforms and for organizers feasible. But there are so many tools, and they're all, or most of them, open source projects. And what needs to happen next is focusing on improving the quality of those tools, because oftentimes they're difficult to use, and so they don't get used.
Does anyone want to talk about how the open source movement is intrinsically tied to the Occupy movement, just through values and how it's constructed and how it's being participated with?
I think it's a reflection of the participatory culture movement that we've been seeing, you know, in everything from Maker Faire to the hackerspace movement that many of us are part of, to increasing interest in citizen journalism. What we were dismissing as blogging 5 or so years ago, now we're taking very seriously as a very legitimate form of reporting. And this is an ongoing movement towards every person in a society having a greater stake in what happens to them, rather than just saying, well, you know, these corporations control the media, and I guess we just have to live with that.
We're getting to the point that protesters are being kicked out as media reporters, even when all they have is a cell phone with a camera on it.
That's such an amazing reversal from a period a couple of years ago when we were debating whether blogging could be called journalism at all, and that's absolutely right. As far as the open source community, I think that along with open source development come great interest in security research and privacy research for their own sakes. And I was fascinated by the Guardian Project because they were the first people that I was aware of who took seriously the idea of democratizing these tools so that any person who doesn't necessarily know a whole lot about, you know, say, rooting their phone and installing a different operating system could potentially benefit from the work that had been done. For me, it started with attending a workshop given by Guardian, where they actually talked about all the projects they had with Tor and their instant messaging anonymization. And I said to myself, all right, how hard would it be if I were an activist, not a technologist, to go through the process of using all these tools? And the answer was, well, it was hard, but I did accomplish it. I'm seeing a lot of developer interest, you know, among the software development community saying, these tools have been started, and we're going to keep promoting them. And there have been a couple of mailing lists that have been astonishingly effective, almost as effective as like a company working on software for money, trying to organize development efforts.
Yeah,
it's really awesome to see. I can talk about more about that if people are interested.
Yes, we should definitely include some links to the Tor guides of how to install a Tor node.
Uh-huh.
And there's one down at NoiseBridge that they're working on doing noise Tor.
So Tor is a really interesting thing. It helps people bust through firewalls built by big countries like China, where if you're in China and you try to go to Google, you'll get a special Chinese government version of Google where they'll try to monitor everything that you're doing, and they'll come and beat down your door and, you know, take you away if you type in, you know, down with whoever the hell in the government. And that's kind of an over-exaggeration, but that's the power that they have right now. And Tor allows you to create a secure tunnel from your computer to a bunch of other computers that you really don't know who runs, and they don't know who you are because it's all a secure tunnel. And it bounces around the internet, and then eventually it spits out somewhere else. Somewhere in the world, and then you get your email, or you get whatever activism thing that you want to read, or you get your the thing that you don't want the government to see, and the thing that you want to stay anonymous to, so that whoever is running that server, let's say Google, doesn't know where you're coming from, because the exit node could be in Brazil, it could be in Seattle, it could be in Antarctica, for all whoever cares. The problem with Tor is that it needs volunteers to run, and especially those exit nodes. And another problem is that those exit nodes kind of instigate some sort of liability towards the person running the exit node. And in most countries, that liability doesn't exist. America, for instance, there's a particular rule somewhere that it doesn't come off my mind right now, but if you are running a service that's providing internet access to a group of people, the government can't necessarily come and beat down your door and, like, take you away to jail if someone browses kiddie porn through your Wi-Fi, or let's say your Tor exit node. But this still happens, at least it's happened in other countries. And even though you're not at risk to get to be legally liable, it can still happen. You can still get taken away to jail. It's kind of bad news. Us at NoiseBridge are running a project called NoiseTor. You give us money, and we efficiently turn this into a Tor exit node on your behalf, or a larger Tor exit node that a bunch of people put money together. And it's a really nice way of being able to support anonymity on the internet without having to deal with the hassle of running a server or having to be necessarily held liable. The servers that we're running are in data centers, so no one's going to beat down your door and take away your personal computer because you've got another server somewhere in your room that's running Tor. And we're running them very, very efficiently, and we're getting a really good deal on bandwidth right now. So if you feel like helping, give us money. You can find out about the problem. Tor.noisebridge.net, we're totally open and transparent as far as getting support for making these machines run as efficiently as possible.
Does anyone want to talk about any other projects that are going on that are especially relevant?
Sure. Yeah. I'd like to jump in and just talk about what I see coming together in New York. So one thing is OccupyTogether.org was created to coordinate all of the disparate efforts in this country and elsewhere to identify what's happening in each location and just to say, you know, we are semi-unified and we have needs that we can articulate. So I would encourage people to start off with OccupyTogether.org. I became aware of that because of the OWS Solutions mailing list. If you Google the Free Network Foundation, that will help you get on that mailing list if you're interested in just like seeing what's going on. And that was the resource I was referring to, where basically it's a bunch of network engineers, software engineers, all of us geeks with ties and interest in this community saying, okay, what needs to be done? Do we need to create another website? Do we want to create a logistics system? What needs done where? And coordinating extremely efficiently. And the great thing about it is that you can choose exactly how much involvement you want. You can say, hey, yeah, I'm going to jump in and become a developer on this project. You can monitor it. You should be aware that, you know, it's an open list. Probably lots of people are monitoring it. But it can certainly clue you into what matches your skill set and your interests.
Very cool. Ella, do you have any specific tools or sites or anything?
Suki is the big one that I've been part of. I'm also starting to do some more with the Serval team, sort of a project designed to do peer-to-peer phone calls off of Android handsets. They're not as security conscious as they should be, but we're in the process of fixing that. My interaction with the technical side has mostly been with specific projects and specific instances. I think we're starting to see a lot of tools are being written, and I think we're starting to see a shift, and stuff is starting to kind of come together as people realize, okay, yeah, we need these tools, but we need specific tools that are easy to use and well thought out for specific use cases. Briarpatch is another interesting tool that's sort of just showing up for secure multi-party communication over heterogeneous media, but I think we're going to see a lot of innovation for a while, and then things will start to shake out as we figure out, okay, these are the four or five tools or whatever it is that work for a lot of our secure communications needs, and then solve these other logistical needs, kind of, you know, things slotting into place. And hopefully we can also make some progress on the existing security tools that are not as easy to use as they should be, like Tor, like SSL, like PGP, like OTR. These are all things that should be very easy to use, but really aren't.
Right.
Matt, do you have any? We've been talking a lot about software, especially, so if you have other things you want to tell us about.
Well, I've been using a couple of things, TextSecure and Redphone. Just kind of investigating them, there are a couple of kind of point-to-point encrypted ways of calling and texting that have been emerging as apps for Android that I've been trying to get a better handle on. But so far, my favorite project has actually been OpenWatch, which is a program that runs in the background of your phone and takes over your phone's camera and microphone so that if you have an encounter with someone, say an authority figure that you need to know the exact details of your encounter as it might become legally relevant later, it's not you're not able to tell whether or not OpenWatch is going on your phone once you've activated it, unless you are able to unlock your phone and actually deactivate it. So it keeps recording until it runs out of memory, more or less. And I think subtle features for making sure that all interactions are recorded and there are multiple eyes on screen, like live casting, what Nicole Aptekar has been doing with trying to live cast events live from OWGS protests, has become like my relevant like intersection with open source technologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been, so Nicole has been doing videography. There's also been photography. There's been some just photographers flying in just to take photos and make sure that it's documented. It's part of our public record. There's another movement called Occupy Design, which involves graphic designers. That's their tool set. And they'd like to create awareness through really excellent posters. And I think that's amazing.
These are all fantastic tools. I want to bring it to the meta and asking about how a lot of these things seem to be based on continued efforts from stuff that was already being created before Occupy started. So that's interesting. And, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to throw one more in there. One of the things I've been very interested in watching, like, the General Assemblies and the human microphones and everything like that, it seems like a very belabored decision-making process. And there was actually a project that was started back in 2008, originally as a Shadow Parliament project, and has then morphed into various incarnations. And one that's currently active is called Your Priorities, which is just a website, yrpri.org, that allows people to put the kind of tactical priorities and it's kind of a non-blocking deliberation platform. Which might be useful for helping people who are engaged in the Occupy movement to try and figure out what it is they want to do and make stronger statements. So, that kind of ties into both the ongoing projects and the things that could be used.
So a lot of this stuff seems to be built on tools that were already in creation before Occupy started.
I want to make a quick comment. So this is something... we are, as we're starting to see these tools which are built specifically for the movement, one of the issues which is coming up in a few places is that we have people releasing tools which are not as secure as they need to be for the things that they're being marketed for, and we have people making, what are effectively false claims. Now, mostly they don't realize that they're false claims. This came up with Fluid Nexus a few months ago, which was a tool that was released specifically for people to, do some form of secure communication on the ground, but it turned out it was neither secure nor anonymous in any way. I think that, if you have a bunch of activists adopting your tool and say your Twitter, that doesn't necessarily mean that you as Twitter have a responsibility to suddenly turn your tool into, the perfect anonymous secure communications tool, although it might be nice if you did. But if you're building something and specifically marketing it to activists or, suggesting it's fit for this kind of purpose, you have accepted a certain kind of onus to make sure that these tools are built properly. We're seeing that again with Vibe, which is some kind of nascent location-based social network thing that was pitched specifically at protesters to Occupy Wall Street. They actually had devs show up, but you know, based on some very initial looks that some people on the pets mailing list have taken at it, it doesn't really look like there's much there. And so this is a case where, you know, tools have been suggested for use where they're really not fit to purpose. And that is one of the places in the interaction which I think is really critical, that people need to be aware if they want to build a tool, you know, if they don't know that they have the skill set required to really do it properly, they should go find people who do have that skill set, you know, to help for things like security, things like privacy, things like anonymity, where, you know, they may get people killed or arrested if they do the wrong thing. You know, and I think this is something where the open source movement really shines, because it means that as an open source tool, you can kind of reach out to people and say, hey, I built this thing, I don't know what the deal is, would you like to come take a look at my code and see if this thing looks safe?
And I absolutely agree with that, and there are a number of GitHub repositories that are totally open. You can clone them, you can inspect them, and if you do happen to be a security expert and a code auditor, it's a great way to help. And I'm speaking again about the Guardian Projects one, because that's the one that I've been looking at.
Yeah. So a really interesting observation on the whole Occupy movement right now is that no one gives a shit about security. The people on the ground that are actually doing the majority of the work, and by work I mean like actually being present, actually keeping their life. I don't think anyone on this podcast right now is actually physically at an Occupy movement anywhere in their local town, city, or village. And so
New York City.
Yeah. And so there are these people out there, and they're totally on the front line, and it's not so much a question of security for a lot of them. And a lot of times they don't really have that concept of like what is secure, what isn't secure. It's just early and first adoption that is what works. And it even works with things that don't involve security. For a couple weeks, a bunch of us were complaining back and forth about the San Francisco Occupy movement and how to provide them proper power and internet. And the solution that worked was someone got up and went out and bought some car batteries and took it over there and hooked up some car batteries and provided an inverter. And someone else went and got one of those little Wi-Fi devices from a Walmart and got that through. And the batteries are totally not going to be useful if we don't recharge them. And we had to scramble to figure out a recharging setup for them. And someone else provided a bicycle with a generator on the back that you could pedal and charge up, which actually is apparently working really well. But the MyWi thing, that's a total security risk. And it's not a viable option because the carrier, whoever that is providing that internet access, could see a spurt of traffic and block it, or could potentially report the end user and block them from, or not block them, but possibly report them, or if there's a takedown notice, they can get taken down. There's no Tor encryption there. There's nothing. But it was first adoption is what sort of goes. And it's not so much a, like, well, let's hold back and let's go get some second opinions about how to make this secure, and let's do our best to make it secure. Security, there's no such thing. Everything will always have a hole in it. PGP has its faults. OTR has its faults. Tor has its faults. It's more about providing something as soon as possible and then providing the next best thing when that is available and having this constant shift.
So the things that are adopted early are not only offered early, but are designed well enough to be used.
You got to get in there, and you got to get in there fast. And a lot of these people out there, too, especially the San Francisco Occupy is a special one, because there's a lot of, quote-unquote, anarchists that hang out there. A lot of them don't like technology. A good personal friend of mine is dealing with a lot of the, was dealing with some of the infrastructure there as far as, like, their web-facing presence, their form, their mailing list, and he had some good stories about how some of the anarchists really don't like dealing with the mailing list because it doesn't provide transparency, and they all want an administrative rights and all this other stuff. So there's also this interesting take on providing technology to people that don't necessarily understand technology, don't understand security, or they might have their own crazy notion of it. and providing a mediation ground between the two of, like, well, we're trying to provide these tools and this is how it's going to be transparent for you and so on, instead of just showing up there and being like, this is the right thing for you because I'm a security expert and I know what the hell I'm talking about. A lot of times that doesn't fly. And so showing up first and being like, yeah, this thing works, here you go, take it, and having them just go with it, that's sort of what wins out. It's going to be really hard to show up someplace and be like, we know you've been using Facebook for your internet communication. We just built this thing that is this crazy mailing list form, Twitter doodad gadget with all these different apps, and it's totally secure. It's like one button, it makes it work. You're still going to have a really hard time getting everybody off Facebook because of how early of an adoption that was, how it was the first thing in, and how accustomed people are to it now. And so there's that sort of like logistical problem that I feel a lot of people in the technology sector for Occupy stuff are not really looking at, is you can build a great tool, but getting it deployed and having adoption is probably the hardest part.
I also think it might be crucial to have people examine what exactly is a security hole, because it might be that a million years of fascinating, what would be a fascinating source of data for someone looking to try and be malicious to the movement, they might not ever discover that. There might actually be more relevant threats, or there might be something that investigators are doing right now that endangers Occupy Wall Street that isn't the least secure tool. It might be something that has been fairly well considered that has an exploit that actually is the biggest thing that stands in the way of making the movement to healthy and sustainable and secure. So I guess it's the other role of security auditors to take a look at what's actually being used to harm, because we could spend a million years developing a wonderful tool. It might not, you know, if our defenses aren't on that side, you know, if our defenses aren't on the side of what's actually being attacked, then it's kind of useless.
Fair enough. Do you
want to
go on about
on design? Sure. So a lot of my background is in how people use kind of very, very quick snap decision-y stuff to diagnose something like a design or how to use an object so that objects can be their own physical instruction manuals. And the same thing applies to weirder concepts like movements or families or gender, that people use this framework of really rapid, like, decisions to just snap decision. That's a them, that's not an us. That person, based on their dress, their movement, the way they act, the way they speak, is a them. They're okay not to listen to. And that's one of the things I've been kind of wrapping my brain around and starting to tweak with getting better design resources to Occupy Wall Street. Because, I mean, if you're a New Yorker, you pass by people, you know, young people, old people, doesn't matter, people kind of dressed in no particular way, holding up cardboard signs with slogans written on them, and people are very, very good at seeing them as not humans, not part of their world, as invisible. And that's something you're seeing in the media's reaction to Occupy Wall Street, that you get to gloss over people with, well, they're just hippies, or they're just slackers. They're people it fits into our imagination to see as people who don't even want jobs. And that's why I felt things like Suits for Wall Street, which was, I believe the group behind that was a proper business attire working group, has been significant in trying to shape the movement. It was a little bit humorous and it was a little bit sarcastic in some ways, but it actually is relevant to make the people seem empathetic, the people seem like people, like, relatable and common, and that their messages are relatable and, like, not disingenuous, to keep them relevant and empathetic, but that we need to start giving people tools to talk, tools to look, tools to, like, frame arguments, that these are the common arguments we're seeing with people disagreeing with Occupy Wall Street. Here are ways we've found to logic around them. Here are ways we've found to frame the argument in positive ways.
You could call it hacking social expectations.
Yes, hacking social expectations.
So what I and a couple of other people have been building is like an open source set of graphics and designs, sort of slogans, charts, graphs, a way to pack up a bunch of different kind of relevant cutting information and give it to people to cunt, print, go to Kinko's, get signs, like giving graphic design to everyone. In a use any way you please, make copy proliferate as much as possible way, partially so that when photos of the movement show up, when they get on the front page of the news, that you do have, it's hard to say these people don't know what they're doing, they don't even have like a clear concise message, because look, big 10-foot signs, it says this is what's wrong, up with this I will not put.
Well, actually, on that point, and maybe this has something to do with expectations.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's been annoying me about the media coverage of all of this is the way that the media keeps saying, "Oh, we don't actually know what they're asking for. We don't actually know what they want from us." And they put it in kind of a way that the Onion satirized quite nicely, where they said, "We're waiting for them to be clear about their demand before we ignore them." I think it's very strange that the media are completely missing the point. They kind of expect people to have very clear opinions about things like tax cuts or healthcare. Yeah. Instead of understanding that this is a more general statement against not just specific aspects of what's been going on, but general notion of inequality in the world.
Oh, I just think one thing I've been trying to frame with some people is sort of a Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, like, tools for the debate, which is kind of ways to frame the arguments and the ideas that we have that acknowledge that it is an incredibly complex situation that is difficult to sum up in a sign.
Yeah, and actually, so maybe this is a kind of weird note, but conservative commentator Jerry Doyle made the very interesting point that if you look at the kind of liberal coverage of Tea Party activities, they always kind of focus on the crazy guys with the shotguns and the Bible thumping maniacs. And in the same way, when the conservative media look at the Occupy movement, they see crazy hippies, smoked out and deranged with all kinds of utopian ideas. And at the same time, if you kind of dig to the bottom of it, there might not actually be all that much difference between the fact the Tea Party and the Occupy movements, in the sense that both are completely fed up of the status quo and are looking for something different. Of course, they find difference in extremes to either side, but the notion and the kind of similarities are absolutely there.
What it's also doing is reiterating to us as a very divided public, which is told over and over and over that there's only two parties and only two ways of aligning and the other alternatives don't matter, is that actually it is a spectrum. And it's been interesting to answer the questions of, okay, exactly how is Occupy, how are the Occupy movements different from the Tea Party movement? But I really appreciate seeing that clear-eyed discussion of sort of post-bipartisanship entering the conversation.
Yeah.
Very cool.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is the idea of sort of intentional legibility, that there's actually a lot of value for these protests in not making demands, not just because they can't then be dismissed easily, but because it makes people actually sit down and talk and have the long conversation, and it changes. I mean, maybe it doesn't play out as well in the external media. It doesn't give the evening news the perfect soundbite. But what it does mean is that means in the occupations and with the people who are on the ground, with the people who are talking to the people on the ground, who are walking by on the street, you get a different kind of conversation. You get a different kind of interaction where people can have that long-term, long-form conversation and kind of actually start talking about the issues, which has been, it's been something that's been interesting in the time that I've spent around Occupy SF and Occupy Melbourne, is seeing those conversations actually happening and seeing that eligibility actually playing out as a very useful characteristic of the space. So I think a lot of the message of the occupation is the occupation. It is the format, it is the experience, not what's said.
That's an, sorry, I think that's very interesting. Like, Ella, you're probably one of the few people who've seen the Occupy movement from on the ground in two different continents. And the fact that you see kind of the same legibility being used to our advantage is a bit surprising. I would have expected that the illegibility was more of a hindrance. And that's the way I've been seeing it, you know, in the mainstream media. So,
I mean, it's definitely, it reads that way in the mainstream media, but you can say, you can look at something like Anonymous as well. It's the exact same kind of illegibility that Anonymous deploys in terms of, you know, there isn't a single Anonymous, there isn't a single demand, there isn't a single project, a single goal. Which is a lot of what the protests are saying, too. You know, it's a lot of people who are very upset kind of about the general conditions of life. And then if you want anything more specific than that, you need to actually talk to individuals. And I think that's where it becomes powerful. And I think that's very much, you know, in the same way that things like general assemblies and a certain degree of consensus are part of the sort of base mimetics of this as a protest, I think the illegibility is also part of that base.
But on the other hand, there's the fact that the media is always looking for kind of the mentionable hero. I mean, in Egypt, there was Alaa al-Fatah and Wael Ghonim. Now, every time I look at you know, videos from the media at the Occupy Wall Street movement, it's always Tulakea. So you know, I'm kind of weirded out by the fact that they're managing to kind of create these heroes that everybody recognizes, while really what they're trying to project is the fact that, you know, everybody is a hero in this thing.
Remember that. I'm anonymous. You're anonymous. We're all anonymous.
And I think the same thing goes for the protests, that the way you fight that, you know, the media trying to give the movement a single message and a single figurehead is to just preserve that illegibility and fight for it and be confusing, you know. And you can be well-designed and serious-looking and confusing, but I think there is a certain amount of that kind of trickster, not really directly, immediately intelligible nature, which is really, really good, because it makes the media even slow down.
I find the cognitive dissonance caused to people who are so used to seeing centralized ideas when facing a distributed protest that's happening all over the world by all different people. That just makes me smile. I don't know. We'll each do closing remarks. So, Ari, you can start.
Sure. I'd just like to note that I've been watching my own involvement, my own commitments change and evolve, and I used to be much more of an on-the-streets protester, and what I learned from that experience over the beginning and middle of the Iraq occupation was that activism can consume as much of your life as you give it and more. As soon as you commit something, you should do it. If you don't think that you can do something, don't offer. I mean, well, yeah, don't offer, because people desperately want your involvement. And, you know, if you have the time to give and the care to give and the skills, fantastic. Please don't flake out. So look at yourself and look at your abilities and make decisions about what you can do to be the best contributor possible without driving yourself crazy and burning yourself out, or taking on more risks to yourself and your family than you're comfortable with.
Thank you. Ella?
I definitely agree with that. I'm spending a lot of time on a lot of different projects right now, and it's hard to keep up with this stuff. I strongly agree that, you know, we have to take care of ourselves as well as everything else, you know, but I don't know. See you in the streets.
Matt?
Hi. So I'd like to say I'm working on a project to try and increase anonymity and give people a basic rule set for happy protesting, and it will check back for details next week. My general advice to anybody is even little things count. Like, it's interesting how Twitter has not been trending Occupy Wall Street. A lot of getting a social movement into the social context is just having it reach a critical mass where it's part of people's everyday lives, and they take a second to say, oh, what is this? What is this newfangled product here? Coca-Cola, what is that? To do the, I've heard this enough times that it becomes relevant thing that people do. It's an interesting psychological experiment, but hearing the same person say something three times and hearing three different people say it seems to offer the same depth and intensity of recall and the amount of opinion change when people are later polled. So keep pushing.
I think that making small contributions and taking on small tasks like that is the other side of deciding how much involvement you want to have, because you realize that you can make a small contribution that can turn out to be surprisingly impactful.
Ruben.
Remember that the internet is not real life, and that technology is good and well and everything, but there are a bunch of people right now, and they're probably pretty cold out in the street fighting for things that you may or may not agree with. And so I implore everyone to take some time off and go and see what this Occupy movement is all about, and don't just follow it on Twitter. Don't just tweet about it or Facebook about it or listen to this podcast, but actually go and talk to some people in real life and see why they are there. Because Twitter can be just as bad as mainstream media and the news in obfuscating what is actually happening.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'd say, well, first, I completely agree with what Alo was saying and Nari about not burning out. I've seen so many really people just burn out over this year, and it's terrible. You know, I'm there myself, but yeah. On the other hand, there's something to be said about the fact that all of the time while we're out on the streets protesting, and that's all well and good as a social activity, while we're doing that, the people that we're protesting against are continuing their activities. So there is some room for being more focused and making kind of achievable goals. So think about not just the broad message, but also what can be achieved on the small scale and in here and now. That way, you know, we can make incremental progress as well as making the larger scale progress, hopefully.
Thank you. And my closing thoughts are just that we're always recreating ourselves through our technologies, but we still have to do things in the real world. And I'm excited to see what we're doing to support these movements, but we still need to be them. So thank you all so much for joining us through all of your time zones. Samari figured out that we're in -7, -4, 0, and +11. So this is fantastic time zone-wise.
Thank you for listening to episode 1 of the Brain Meets podcast. Our theme music has been the instrumental Utopia by Yacht. The clip at the beginning of this podcast about the evolution of society from the 1960s onward comes from a lecture given by Ram Dass in 1989. We clipped it from the Psychedelic Salon podcast, episode number 243. For information about any of the people, organizations, or projects mentioned in this podcast, please check the podcast notes at either blog.bl00cyb.org/brainmeets or www.alwayssababa.com/brainmeets. That's blog.bluesibe.org/brainmeets or www.alwayssababa.com/brainmeets. This podcast is published under a Community Commons Attribution Share Alike non-commercial license. Please feel free to repost, remix, and reuse the content. Until next time, be well.